Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable on this Friday, the 16th of July. An absolute delight to have you with us on this Friday morning, and a beautiful Friday as well. 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. It is the 16th of July. We have a terrific panel. We have a lot to talk about, so let's get to it. We welcome your letters, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and that is how you can get in and talk about what's on your mind. I was going to say what you want to talk about, but that's not true. We want you to stay on topic of what we're talking about. It's most helpful, actually. Panel at WAMC.org. Let's introduce the panel. Alan Chartok, good morning, sir. How are you?
Yo, I'm fine.
Excellent. Good to...
And I hope you are too, Joe.
I am. I was off yesterday. I went to the city for the first time since November of 2019, and which was not COVID, but it's when I hurt my legs. And it was really nice to be back in the city. You've been down since, right, Alan?
Yes, I have. Yeah. It's really quite something, and there have been some very subtle changes. I remember going on Amsterdam Avenue to Bodrum, a very good restaurant, with Roselle, and we were staying near there. And on the street itself was a, they had moved everything out of the restaurant into the next to the bike lane and put up a tent, and it was huge. Now, what's going to happen with all those places? I don't know. But it's quite a thing.
A lot of things closed, and but a lot is happening and bustling. And I showed my vaccination card a lot yesterday, which was I thought good. I wore my mask all day. I couldn't take it off, so that was I thought good. But David Soares, Alan's talking about outside dining. They built a huge Krispy Kreme donut shop on the corner of, I think it may be 50th Street, 50th and Broadway. It's huge. And, but it's inside. So now what they did is they just brought the donuts. They just have a conveyor belt that brings them right out on the street. And you just walk by, give them a 10 spot, and keep walking with a dozen donuts.
These people want to take years off my life.
It was just a great moment. I was like, oh, wow. First of all, didn't know Krispy Kreme was still in business, much less having a location, a very easy location on Broadway in New York. All right. Aaron Pasitti is here. He is a professor of economics at Siena College. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, everyone.
Oh, your mic isn't on. Let's try. There you go.
Good morning, everyone.
No? Aaron's mic on three? We get Aaron on three? Hi, Aaron.
Good morning,
there
everyone.
There you go. Look at that. There we go. Excellent.
A very dramatic pause.
Yeah, we just plug things in and all better. Sorry about that. Okay, good to see you.
Good to be here.
Very nice to have you here. Judith Enck is with us. Judith, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Good morning. Joe, I'm curious, who asked to see your vaccination card? Because no one's ever asked me.
Really?
Is that my card?
Is that absolutely true? Look at me, like
no,
I'm saying
I'm
he's lying. You know. let's see. I showed it at MoMA.
Uh huh.
I showed it at the Colbert Show.
Careful now, you're gonna tell on yourself.
I know. And I showed it
Krispy Kreme.
No, I didn't have to.
Shake Shack. I was at Shake Shack.
And Amtrak.
Amtrak. Oh, good. So Amtrak, you have to show your vaccine card.
You do. You have to authorize and show it. Yeah.
And if you don't have the card, you don't go on Amtrak.
Also, Amtrak are mask very aggressive in wearing a mask all the way on your trip. They will yell at you if you're in your slumber in your seat. And in your drooling, your mask falls down. They will tap you on the shoulder and tell you to put it over your face.
Excellent. I love that. All right. I'm taking Amtrak.
There you go. Good. No, it was wonderful. It was a good experience. And you get to see the Moynihan Train Hall, which is absolutely beautiful. Okay. Everybody is here. We can get started. And I introduced everybody, didn't I, Alan? Yeah. I think I got everybody.
Well, I was there. David was there. Judith was there.
Yeah. Aaron. We're good.
The Aaron the Economist was there.
Aaron, thank the you. Economist. All right. So the governor of this state, and when I say this state, I mean the one that we are currently in, this part of the panel anyway, is Governor Cuomo. And it is now been announced that he will be questioned in his sexual harassment inquiry. He is expected to face investigators on Saturday. That and a sign that the Attorney General's inquiry may be nearing its final stages. David, can you guess the first question I'm going to ask you? Governor Andrew Cuomo is expected to be questioned on Saturday by investigators from the New York State Attorney General's office, signaling that a four-month inquiry into several sexual harassment accusations may be entering its final stages. June Kim and Ann Clark, the two outside lawyers hired to lead the investigation that is being overseen by Letitia James, the state attorney general, are expected to interview the governor in Albany, according to two people familiar with the matter. The lawyers have spent months gathering hours of testimony from several women who have accused Mr. Cuomo of sexual misconduct or harassment. The lawyers have also in recent weeks interviewed several senior administration officials in preparation for questioning of the governor. Alan, your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, I think that the Attorney General is in a tough spot. She's hired these outside lawyers to come in and to do this questioning and to Tish James, of course, that is, to do this investigation. Nevertheless, everybody knows she's the head person. And if, in fact, there is a move to disqualify in one way or another Andrew Cuomo from running for a fourth term, there will be people, because there are a lot of people who still admire the guy. I meet them all the time, and they get mad at me for being too mean and all the rest of it, but they're there, and there are a lot of them, and there are a lot of them there. So now Tish James, who is a politician and who has risen through the ranks to be attorney general, which is always the next stop before being governor, is in a tough spot, because if her people go ahead and try to disqualify him, there are going to be a lot of people really angry at Tish James. That's for sure. So, and by saying, well, what we got outsiders to do the investigation, people will say, yeah, we heard that one before. So this is a tough spot for her.
So the New York Times headline, I don't know what it is in the print edition. I'm just looking at what was in the online. But the original headline, the headline is Cuomo to be questioned in sexual harassment inquiry. The initial headline was Cuomo to face interrogation in state case. Is that an apt word, David? Interrogation? That seems a little bit.
No, it's not an apt word. And as a matter of fact, this is all still part of the fact-finding process that investigators have to go through. We knew the moment that this was announced that this day was coming. That day is just happens to be here, now. I think there's been enough time, and from certainly everything I understand about this case, we have had a group of people who have been intensely out there. Speaking with members of the staff, speaking with the people who've brought forth those complaints, and that's what you have to do, so that when you do have this one moment where for the lack of a better word, the target of your inquiry is in your presence, you have to be so prepared so that the areas that you're going into are areas that that are really important. In terms of making your case. Now, I will say this. Investigators have to go into it with a very open mind and not be so directed in their inquiry that they're trying to, achieve a goal. You have to be open and go where the answers take you. And that's the reason why it's taken a while for them to really speak with a whole host of different people. And I can assure you that during this inquiry, these people will be prepared.
So the paragraph that I just read said this is going to focus on the sexual harassment claims. But obviously, my understanding was they were also going to be investigating nursing homes. They were also going to be investigating the book deal. So will they just ask questions on sexual harassment, or will they also ask questions about those issues?
Well, first of all, I cannot see all of those issues being addressed in one sitting.
Right.
I think that this is going to be specifically the complaints that have been leveled against the governor from a number of different people with respect to the harassment claims. The nursing home is an entirely different beast, as is the book deal. And I do recall reading somewhere that the Eastern District of the U.S. Attorney's Office, they were the agency inquiring about the book deal. I could be wrong, but that's what I believe.
Mm. Judith.
Well, it's kind of sad that we have to keep a scorecard and the number of very serious investigations going on, but we do. I think it's important to look at how things unfolded. So when these allegations of sexual harassment and sexual predator behavior were first lodged, the governor was mostly quiet. Remember, he was behind closed doors, not taking questions from reporters, still doesn't take many questions from reporters. So we were met with silence with some pretty jarring allegations. And then the governor apologized for, quote, making people feel uncomfortable. I don't think that phrase really helped his cause, because sexual harassment allegations is not about making people feel uncomfortable. And then he vigorously denied any wrongdoing. So, you know, this New York Times article is what many expected to see. This is when you get toward the end of a investigation like this, you talk to the target, typically last. I thought the most important part of the article, though, is the quote from Richard Azzopardi, a senior advisor to Governor Cuomo. He issued a statement saying, quote, the continued leaks are more evidence of the transparent political motivation of the Attorney General's review. And then the Times added, he provided no evidence that the AG was leaking information. So what happened is, first, there was a call for Attorney General James to do this investigation. She didn't raise her hand and volunteer to do it. I think it was the way to buy time for the governor, and then in fairness, to have a thorough investigation by two outside professional employment attorneys. And so the posture of the governor's office has been, we welcome this investigation, but the last few weeks, it has been to attack Attorney General James, to discredit her, to say this investigation is politically motivated. I think that's pretty troubling. And I also think it points to the fact that the governor knows his own behavior. He probably knows this is not going to be a very positive review of his behavior and potentially criminal behavior. So now they are setting the stage for attacking the Attorney General for doing her job.
Judith, you are shocked that there is an executive from Queens under investigation for harassment, attacking a prosecutor?
Well, David, I don't think we should minimize a sitting governor attacking a prosecutor.
No, this is the strategy. It worked for the other executive from Queens, who used to be our president, and I think that this is the standard playbook that, unfortunately, we have to become accustomed to.
Aaron, we got about 2 minutes.
I'm curious whether Cuomo has enough political capital to do what he's doing, which is deny he did anything wrong, attack the attorney general, and really just try to insulate himself so he can take a couple blows and get reelected. So, you know, whether he has that much capital or not is questionable, but I mean, I'm curious to hear what David and Alan and Judith have to say about that. I mean, is this just him just ready to take some blows and then move on, or do you think this is more serious than—
Well, it's worked so far, right, Alan? I mean—
Yeah. And what are his choices? He could resign, pardon me, and go away, Or he could be tough guy Andrew and do what he's doing.
And he's not resigning. So far,
and yeah, which has so far been working for him.
Right.
Do I think, and I'm interested in what David Soares may have to say on this, do I think that newspapers like the New York Times or the Times Union or others sometimes have their own agendas? And that if you read the thing, the stories, and you, as you pointed out before, the first story headline was really, well, obnoxious, that's a big part of the political process. And by the way, Cuomo didn't only go after the attorney general. He went after the controller, too, and said he was trying to get elected to a higher office, to the governor's mansion also, which was something I asked him about. He said he's running for controller.
So I want to hear David's response and talk more with the whole group about that. We'll take a pause, and then we'll come back, and then we'll interrogate David Soares. All of that and much, much more. We welcome you to our discussion panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares on the program this morning. We will continue our conversation and welcome your letters after this news break from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we have a great panel here. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares. Before we went to a break, we were talking about the governor of the state being questioned over the weekend by lawyers in the investigation into sexual harassment. Alan asked you a question, David, right before the break about the role of the press, their agenda, and what to make of that. Your thoughts.
So first and foremost, the investigators here are at an incredible disadvantage, right? Because as an investigator, as a prosecutor, when you're working on a case, an investigation that happens to be one that has a lot of media interest, you're prohibited from commenting, because if you comment, you could be unduly influencing your investigation. But the target, or the people being investigated, they have free rein over the press. I'm sure there was a different headline that was supposed to be in that printed journal today, right? But what we have and what we've seen are people who work in administrations. I'm not suggesting that that's what happened here, but you have people that work, whether it was the Trump administration or different administrations, they aggressively work their contacts in the press. And they're very influential. If you don't do this, you know, you're not getting this.
Just for the record, one of the things that we cleared up over the break is that the headline that is in the print edition is that he was going to be, what was the word?
Interrogated,
yeah.
Okay. No, but my point being, the AG's office is at are at an incredible disadvantage in terms of what is getting out to the public. They're prohibited from engaging in any kind of pretrial media, and the other side is free to, you know, to wax poetically on this very interesting take. And it's embarrassing, actually, when you know you are when you are you know, putting forth political agendas, as opposed to you have actual human beings that have made allegations about their experiences in the workplace that have triggered, you know, the AG's office to engage in a fact-finding endeavor. And to suggest that that is now all, you know, politically motivated, or even that, you know, one of the best politicians in this state, one of the best politicians, we have an amazing comptroller. This is the nicest man that we have in politics, and I dare you to find any politician or anyone to say otherwise, except maybe for the one that's saying it now.
Alan, what do you make of that?
Well, I know Tom DiNapoli very well, and I agree with David. He is the nicest person and probably the most competent person in state government right now. So he's certainly right about that, and the governor made an accusation that both he and the attorney general were out there actively looking to see who would support them if they ran for governor. That was the governor's remarks. As a party, by the way, who is the guy who carries this the mail for Cuomo was my student years ago, and a very bright guy.
Did you teach him everything he knows?
You have the right to remain silent, Alan. Anything you say can and will be used against you.
And he's one of the toughest guys I know, yeah, right. So anyway, I think this is fraught with danger for anybody who runs against him in a primary. I think the only one who really seems to be ready, or not ready, but being readied, is the Attorney General herself. I don't think she can win if she runs against Cuomo. But if Cuomo's out for any reason, and this speaks to why, you know, the political motivation of politicians is always suspect, if he's out of there, then she has a good shot at succeeding to that. I know Judith doesn't agree with this, but, I think one and one makes two.
Judith?
Well, I think the governor and his staff are making a mistake by treating this like it's a political campaign of sorts. This is a very serious legal inquiry. And I don't think the lawyers, the outside counsel in the Attorney General's office really care about Rich as a party criticizing their investigation for being politically motivated. I mean, I think it's just not on their radar at all. They are following the facts. Now, the governor has his own counsel. They've got some pretty serious legal problems on their hands. It's not surprising that they're trying to diminish the importance of the investigation by the Attorney General, call in to question her motivation. None of that really matters. I guess I disagree with Alan when he says Tish James is in a tough spot. She's not in a tough spot. She has to follow the facts. She has to follow the law. She has very capable attorneys working for her. And while the governor has been able to dodge problems in the past, and I know a lot of people are impatient that this has not been concluded earlier, this is a pretty serious legal inquiry, and the facts are the facts. And
you discount political motivation on the AG's part completely. In other words, because I'm here to tell you that if in fact the Cuomo drops out, she's going to be a candidate for governor of New York.
That may be the case, but remember,
if he doesn't, she isn't.
I worked in the New York Attorney General's office for 8 years, and you have career staff who do their jobs. And if the Attorney General tries to interfere in a political way, the career staff push back, as evidenced by the nursing home report that the Attorney General issued, which kind of opened the floodgates into questioning whether the nursing home death numbers were accurate or not. That was, her career staff doing an inquiry. My guess is she probably was not that happy to be out there publicly with such a damning critique of the governor. And if I'm remembering the scandals right, that was prior to the 8 or 9 women who came forward with the sexual harassment, sexual predator charges. So, I think you can't, in that office, you can't just bury things, because you've got really high-powered lawyers and investigators that do their job. And it often does box them into a corner. Now, she can influence what the news release says, but she can't really say, in this instance, let's say there is a finding of wrongdoing or there isn't a finding of wrongdoing. She can't change that conclusion once the investigation is done.
One of the things that we read in the article, what I read earlier just a few moments ago, was that this was an indicator that the case was nearing conclusion. Does that seem right to you, David, number one? And number two, what is that? Is there any sort of time frame we can take away from that?
Usually when you're having a conversation with the person who is the focus of your investigation, it does trigger, it should trigger the sign that that the investigation is coming to a conclusion. They will conduct their interview. They will assess what they're able to derive from that investigation and then apply it to everything that they know. And all the other information that they've been able to gather. And then they'll be able to make assessments as to whether or not any of the conduct that took place, had arisen to an act where criminal liability can be assessed, or whether, you know, the acts seem to be acts of that violate ethics. And then they will make the appropriate referrals to different people. But, you know, along the lines of what Judith was saying, you know, I think that people who, you know, follow the politics of the state, they're always attributing motivations to, you know, elected officials. I certainly had people attributing, you know, my political motivations when I prosecuted Alan Hevesy. And when I did that because I was the only office willing to prosecute that case. And the same with the attorney general in this instance. She has jurisdiction over it. She has jurisdiction over it because she was given jurisdiction over this case. And her people are doing what her people must do. I think it was an excellent. I think it was excellent on her part to bring in, you know, outside expertise. It does create a certain, you know, level of a certain wall there that she's not going to have as much influence as she would had it been her own, you know, staff investigating those cases. And I think that she did that, and that was a very good move on her part. And the facts are going to take you where they take you. And the one thing that I can say is that people should temper their expectations. People should temper their expectations. The same thing that happened with our president during all of those investigations. We thought, we got him, and it didn't turn out to be the case.
Well, just to be clear, David and Judith, the governor and the governor and I, it's fairly clear, are on the outs. So I'm just following this the way that I, you know, think it ought to be. The governor's people have made accusations. They have said that the attorney general is going around talking about her prospects as governor. Are you guys denying that? I mean, it's very nice to say the kinds of things you're saying, and I understand where you're coming from. That's quite clear. But do you really think?
No, Dr. Chartok,
that they would lie about that.
Dr. Chartok, let me just say this, okay? Mm-hmm. And I'll say this emphatically. First of all, I think your relationship with the governor, you can overcome that, and you can go to Krispy Kreme and probably have a, you know, share a glaze, and you can work that out. But let me just say this. If, in fact, the attorney general has made any public comments or any comments that could be overheard by any person about her aspirations to take that position or to run for that position, that would be the most foolish thing, idiotic thing that could be done. Now, I'm not suggesting to you that it happened. You're telling me that you know, there's information out there to that effect. As a prosecutor conducting investigations on a specific target, the idea of speaking about that target in any form, or even, you know, at a price chopper, that would be ridiculous. That would be foolish.
I've not heard Tish James say that she's planning to run for governor. I've heard people encouraging her to run for governor. I think she's been pretty disciplined because she realizes that she has to be above the fray here. She cannot compromise this investigation. But let's play this out. Let's say she does want to run for governor. It doesn't matter in terms of what her investigators are looking at. They cannot come to her and say, we found that, you know, it's a brutal place to work in the governor's office, borderline hostile work environment, but we didn't find any indication of wrongdoing or criminality. You know, that's our conclusion. she can't say, you know, change that. That's not how it works in the Attorney General's office.
I don't think that that's the point. I think the point is if I'm the prosecutor and my target occupies a political office and I have expressed the desire, you know, in the midst of my conducting an investigation on that office, if I've expressed my desire to seek that office, that right there, you've basically conducted an investigation. You're probably going to get an indictment that will end up being either dismissed or you'll have that case taken from you because you've expressed something that amounts to a conflict of interest. That's a poison pill in your own case.
It's just the mere fact that she holds that office. But again, I have not heard her say that she's planning to run for governor. And there was this little bit of a dilemma when these accusations were made and people called for an investigation. Who's going to do it? Jay Cope? That would not be credible.
No.
You know, I think
you could have been the third lawyer that they hired. Look, they hired lawyers. The Attorney General hired lawyers. And you can write this down. And Alan said it, and I'm sticking with it. If Andrew Cuomo doesn't run for governor, she will. If Andrew Cuomo does run for governor, she won't. I think that's pretty powerful evidence. And by the way, Judith, people don't go around and talk to people in supermarkets about whether they're going to run or not. You'll remember Charlie McCarthy and Edgar Bergen. You know, they have other people who say that stuff for them. No, I'm not buying.
I don't think it matters whether she wants to run for governor or not, because it appears that she is handling the issue appropriately, like David said, by having outside counsel. So whether she does or doesn't, it seems like she has her bases covered, and maybe that's part of some larger strategic ploy. But, you know, there has some very this case has some very Trumpian rings to it. The headline using the word interrogation when it's just part of the fact-finding mission and questioning. You know, the one thing Trump was successful at was controlling the narrative, and it looked no matter where the facts pointed. And it seems like that's what Cuomo's doing, is just taking these allegations, answering the questions, going through the case, making it seem like he is being persecuted by someone who may or may not want to run for governor. I mean, that's a strategic play on his part. So I think in addition to the fact-finding, there's also the control of the narrative that's important here. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out between the questioning this weekend and whenever a conclusion is reached.
Let's take a break.
We'll
take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters on this. We will get to those in just a moment, right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning, 8 minutes before the hour of 10 o'clock. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Pacitti, and David Soares. Let's go to some letters here, and we go to this one from Sally. While the question of Governor Cuomo's actions worry me, I really wonder why nothing happened with Trump. All right. Robert writes, good morning, panel. I'm 64. I've seen a lot of political skullduggery. Governor Cuomo was, quote, there for the people of New York when we were at our darkest since Vietnam. This pandemic was dread in April of 2020. I will vote for him if he runs again. Everyone is marred. He showed leadership.
So that means, because this letter writer believes the governor did a good job handling COVID, it's okay if, in fact, the facts show that he sexually harassed young women. We can overlook that because this guy's judgment is he handled COVID well. I don't think that's going to fly.
The point is, it will fly with people like the letter writer. That's a point I made earlier, Judith. which is that when you are making an assessment, if you're the Attorney General of Tish James and you are wondering whether to run or not, you had better believe that it is relevant, that they're an awful politically relevant, and, you know, there seems to be a lot of ignoring of politics here, that a lot of people are going to vote for Andrew Cuomo, like the letter writer.
Judith, I think we ought to have a new drinking game. Whenever Alan says Attorney General Tish James and mentions her running, we just have to drink in a non-paper cup, by the way.
A lot of coffee.
Yeah.
But I do want to point out that there was a recent Siena poll where 2/3 of those polled say they do not want Cuomo to run again, or they want him to step down. So I don't. I will argue.
There's a big difference. There's a big difference between the two of those. It was not that they want him to step down. It was that they don't want him to run again. And
that's what I said.
You didn't hear me.
Can rerun the tape. I said 2/3 either don't want him to run again or want him to step down.
Right.
So,
but you see, there's a big difference between not wanting him to run again and wanting him to step down. What I'm trying to say, and what I think you're. Where I think your words may be misinterpreted, if that's what you meant, is that they did not say that they want him to step down. They said that they don't want him to run again, and they've been saying that, by the way, all along, even before this.
And I think it doesn't matter in terms of Tish James, the Attorney General's, you know, she took an oath. She has to follow the facts. Whether the poll said that 90% of New York voters want Cuomo to run again. I don't think it factors into her decision on how to handle this investigation.
Well, yes, but you raised the question of what people want in terms of the poll. That's what I was responding to. I think it would be fine if somebody else ran for governor of New York. I'd love to see Tom DiNapoli run, to tell you the truth.
Feeding into Azzopardi's theories, huh? Look at you. You're starting rumors here.
What? I have no idea what you're talking about, David. But the fact is that, you know, if you're a politician and you're the comptroller or you're the attorney general, you're next up. That's the way that people look at contemporary politics. I hear every word Judith is saying. Listen, if they find out that Cuomo is guilty of serious wrongdoing, well, you know, then they have to do what they have to do. But the letter writer who wrote and said, what happened to Trump during all of this? That was interesting. The allegations against him were far worse, and nothing happened.
Just to clarify, because I want to be sure that we have this right, when it comes to the poll itself that we were referencing is the Siena College poll from July 1st,
right,
released on July 1st. It says that among Cuomo's base, 53% of Democratic voters polled to not support impeaching him, 25% support doing so among Black voters, from which Cuomo has drawn consistent support during the last 6 months. 55% oppose impeachment, 17% support it. Independent voters are split. However, while most want to him to remain in office and finish his term, the strongest preference is for him to not seek another 4 years for the post that he's held for the last decades.
And as I said, that's what that opinion has been even before all of this stuff came out. Right. In other words, people said, OK, it's enough now. 3 terms is enough.
A majority of voters, 56% to 35%, would prefer a generic, quote unquote, someone else to Cuomo winning re-election, the poll found, including 60% of independents and 42% of Democrats.
So who are the someone else?
Grimace.
That's always the issue. Who's the someone else? You know, so theoretically they want someone else. Okay, now name the someone else. Anybody? Judith, you have anybody in mind?
No. I mean, I'll watch this with interest.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We'll move on to other topics. We have a lot to discuss this morning, and we certainly will get to your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We will be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Judith Thank, Aaron Pacitti, and David Soares. We welcome your letters. All right, let's go to other stuff here. Aaron, let's put you on the spot and talk about President Biden's aggressive economic ambitions. So the $3.5 trillion blueprint under consideration in the Senate would deliver at least temporarily on the economic promise of a unified Washington run by Democrats. This is its passage in Congress remains far from assured with the series of hurdles in the coming months, including filling in key details on taxes and spending and holding together a fragile Democratic coalition. But if the plan's central components become law, it would be the capstone achievement that Democrats had promised when they won a pair of Senate elections in January to gain narrow control of Congress and come with a reach that could exceed its cost.
So this is probably the most aggressive piece of economic legislation almost since the New Deal. This is major. And what it responds to are two issues that I want to start talking about this with, and that is the alarming increase in income inequality, which produces an inequality in opportunity, and also a declining labor force. We had the baby boomers enter the workforce in the 1960s, and now they're retiring. So the combination of rising inequality and diminished economic opportunity, in addition to declining labor force participation, are two of the largest headwinds to a long-term prosperity in the United States. So Biden's bill, which is essentially cobbling together part of his American Jobs Plan, which was investment in physical infrastructure, and his American Families Plan, which was investment in human infrastructure, are kind of folded into this $3.5 trillion proposal. So lowering the cost of public education, providing subsidized child care and paid family leave, the cash assistance to families with children, expanding Medicare, universal pre-K education. All of these are programs that aren't designed to stimulate the economy in the short term. These are designed so that the next generation can achieve a higher standard of living and more economic opportunity than the current generation. It's going to take years, if not decades, for a lot of this investment, provided the budget passes, to bear fruit. So it's extremely urgent. And I was happy to see that Bernie Sanders said, well, this is less than we were hoping for, but this is a good piece of legislation and we're moving in the right direction. So the fact that a lot of progressives who would like to have seen something larger are on board with this is a good sign. But it's going to come down to, you know, two moderate Democratic senators, and I see David shaking his head and rolling his eyes, as I'm doing, who have their own narrow political interests put ahead of everybody else. And what I can't wrap my head around is Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia.
Who looks like Joe Theismann, by the way.
Yeah.
He does.
But in worse suits.
Yes.
Yeah. you know, he's a senator from literally the poorest state in the nation. Broadband access is spotty at best in West Virginia. They're like 49th in education. This budget is designed to improve opportunity for Joe Manchin's constituents. He's smart enough to know that, I think, but he's clearly, you know, but 20 or 30 years down the road, this is irrelevant to Joe Manchin today and getting reelected. So, I mean, that's what Democrats are up against, is essentially two moderates who, you know, are just objecting to, well, we don't like the tax increases, or, you know, we're concerned about the size of the deficit. That's like complaining about the grass being too long when you're watching your house burn. Well, there are bigger issues at stake here than, well, it's, you know, a large and ambitious budget proposal. Well, what's the alternative at this point?
It makes you ask the question, boy, do I prefer the purist or the corrupt pig, you know?
Yeah, and I think with the progressive wing, they're coming off of the purist pedestal and saying, no, this is not perfect. No, this is smaller than what we wanted, but it's addressing a lot of the issues we have in common. I don't know how you get Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema on board when you're trying to do something ambitious, because there's probably 100 things they could raise their hand and say, well, we don't like that. And then you essentially get it, chiseled down. I would hope that that's the plan, is that, you know, you throw these two senators a bone so they vote for it, and you have something that's good but not perfect.
You know, these people know what their political survival is all about. You don't. None of you do. The fact is that he is sure that the electorate in West Virginia doesn't give a damn about what's right. They just have a particular political, sociological orientation, and they're sticking with it. And they're two, and the senator and Sinema all know what their people want, and they're going to give it to them. It's that simple.
Well Alan, I understand that, but
the same
was said about the Affordable Care Act, right? You know, the Republican red states didn't want it. And when they got a taste of it, they loved it. Now, I'm wondering if, based on what you've just said, you know, Monday, a few days from today, we're going to see a lot of those, you know, child care tax credit checks. If we're going to see those states returning them mm-hmm. out of principle, because mm-hmm. I assure you, they will not.
Couldn't agree with you more. Couldn't agree with you more.
And I think that's one of the most important parts of the Biden agenda. What I don't understand is the child credits have arrived in people's bank accounts already, I think starting yesterday. So that's not a proposal. This is families are getting $300 per month for children younger than six, $250 per month for children ages 6 to 17, as long as the family doesn't make more than $150,000 a year. And this is an attempt to cut child poverty in half. I think it's really hard to argue against that in West Virginia, as Aaron said, one of the poorest states in the union.
Part of the job of politicians is to pass legislation, but it's also part of a politician's job to explain why certain policies can be beneficial to people who might see things differently. Joe Manchin could be using his bully pulpit to tell his constituents that, yes, this is something very different than what we've done before. This might run counter to some of your political beliefs. But, you know, trust me on this. This is going to be good for the state of West Virginia in the long term.
And I think that what's been frustrating me about all of this, all of these discussions, is that the Biden administration has not brought all of the talent of our federal government to literally break down what this translates to. So if you say, whoa, there is, you know, $20 bazillion going to Arizona that is going to, because these programs are going to benefit these specific targeted places. So that as you're making these proposals, you're defining it, and then you're going out to the very states and talking about what this means as a way to try to influence these senators who seem to be stuck on stupid.
Mm-hmm. One thing I want to go back to that Judith mentioned, the child care credit. Let's call that what that is. That is the first step towards universal basic income. That is a government cash payment to families with children. That should be encouraging for progressives that template is there. Obviously, we're not going to get to a universal basic income anytime in the next decade.
You tell me my baby getting money?
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know.
I'm getting this baby coming in October.
Hurry up.
There are income limits. But, you know, the other thing that is important to talk about is, you know, when the president or Congress proposes something with a big price tag, the first question is, well, how are we going to pay for it? The revenue's there. IRS tax enforcement of the current tax law is one way to raise revenue. Raising taxes back to where they were under President Reagan is another solution. Most of the income and the wealth in the United States is concentrated in the richest 1%. So you're talking about millionaires and billionaires. And they've seen their tax bill decline since the 1980s.
They're spending that money going to space, yo. I saw it last week.
Yes, sure.
Air flights to space. You got so much money, you can go to space.
Alan, were you going to say something? I thought you were going to say something. Am I wrong?
I'm always going to say something.
Okay.
But I forgot what I was going to say.
All right, that's all right. That's fine.
And even if tax increases aren't as high as progressives would want, the government can borrow money from the public at exceptionally low interest rates, and the return on infrastructure and education investment will be large enough over the next few decades that not only can the government pay back bondholders that lent it money, but also make money and make the country wealthier in the process. So it's not a matter of if the government can raise money to fund an initiative like this. It's a matter of whether they want to. So there's the political will aspect. It's not a financial question.
I think that the hawks, the budget hawks that were always present during the Obama administration and somehow lost all their feathers during the Trump administration, they really have nothing to say. Nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, when homeowners in the state of New York, you know, are not receiving the tax benefits that they received prior to 2016, right? That should say it all. You gave tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires on the backs of the middle class. And now that you have this proposal that is designed to strengthen the poor and the middle class, go for it.
When you think about the ways in which Republicans have been wrong or have flip-flopped on their principles, you know, Trump's tax cuts, $1.5 trillion. All of the Tea Party members, all of the deficit hawks were not only, they weren't silent, they were 100% in favor of that plan. But when those same people, when Obama inherited the biggest economic recession since the Great Depression and wanted to pass a stimulus bill, they were 100% opposed to that. They were predicting runaway inflation. Well, 12 years later, we don't have that.
But we are getting the same rhetoric from them on Biden's stimulus proposal, which is ambitious and in trouble.
But these things are extremely popular with the voting public. They might not be popular with politicians, but I think politicians have to acknowledge the fact that investment in physical and human infrastructure is popular amongst their constituents.
You're absolutely right about that, as evidenced by Mitch McConnell, right, in Kentucky, having to make a public declaration about what Kentucky's getting, and then having to make the admission that they're not getting it because of him, which again brings me back to the earlier point. I'm shocked that the economists in the apparatus that we call the United States federal government under Joe Biden, they haven't broken it down to what each state is going to, how they're going to benefit. And then the appeal becomes to, hey, since we can't convince, you know, the Republicans here to go along with this, let's go talk to their people. And we'll stop in Arizona, and we'll stop in West Virginia, too.
All right. We have a lot of letters on this, so let's do those until we probably bring us down to the bottom of the hour. Barbara says it's too bad they can't put a clause in the infrastructure legislation that any senator or congressperson who votes no will not receive funding for their state or district if it passes. And she does subject head that pipe dream. Cinnamon Mansion. By the way, I am enjoying the various, this listener has a spot on, but I am enjoying the various listener spellings of Joe Manchin's name. Okay. Ben says to get those senators on board with the Biden agenda, do what will get their attention, pay them more than Koch-related think tanks, business associations, etc. It's the language that they understand. This for Aaron. Manchin is a big-time infrastructure proponent who will pass both infrastructure bills. He played the same political game when he supported Obamacare. He stressed paying for Obamacare fully with taxes and adding not a penny to deficits and got his way. The strategy reelected him in the state of West Virginia. Let's see. Erica says, the earned income credit comes at the end of the year. Everyone is acting like this is new. It is not. You just get it over 12 months instead of when you file. This is such an easy sell. We have already been doing it. Is that true?
Well, the earned income tax credit is a separate tax credit that phases out as incomes go up. And I don't think the child payment is a 100% substitute for the earned income tax credit.
And also the child credit expires after this year.
Right.
And
one year, right?
Yeah. So parents will get it this year, and then it'll be interesting if it stops and what the political reaction to that will be.
We go to Helen, who says, what about helping seniors? They are the voters and
Absolutely.
They are the spenders.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Kay says it's not clear that universal basic income is a quote-unquote progressive idea. Silicon Valley is very supportive of this because they want robots to take the jobs of working class people, and then they want the working class to not rise up and rebel, to be complacent. Universal basic income is humanitarian aid in a way, but it's also a way to get the poor to accept being poor. You are nodding, Aaron.
Yeah. I mean, a universal basic income is also very popular amongst some libertarians who acknowledge the threat of technological unemployment. So no, it's not solely a progressive issue.
Susan asked this question. Please help me understand, panel, why people with over $100,000 need support payments.
Go
ahead.
It's $150,000 a year. If you live in an expensive city and you have multiple children, $150,000 definitely sounds like a lot. But you know, some families need that financial help.
Do you know what a snack? My wife is, you know, expecting. Do you know what a snack size sundae costs right now at McDonald's? It's like $3.
$299?
It was like $3.
I'm sorry. 24 cents. Help me understand. I know I'm going down a rabbit hole here, but what does that have to do with your wife being pregnant?
She has these cravings.
Cravings.
But McDonald's was the place that if you had $10 and went to McDonald's,
you could eat for a week.
You could eat for a week, and now it's like that's no longer the case. So as people make comments about, well, it's 100, what is a person with 100? Everything is more expensive. Everything. And I apologize for saying anything about McDonald's. I was just trying to make the point. Food costs a whole lot more than it did before.
No, I don't think you have to apologize.
And housing.
But, and housing, that's right.
Part of it is just to make the idea of government cash payments to people more palatable. So you make this program as expansive as possible. Why it's $150,000 and not maybe you double the amount of the subsidy for people earning $75,000 or less. You know, there's a lot of possibilities, but I think that the broader this program is, the more political support it can gather, and therefore the greater the likelihood that it remains a permanent part of our social safety net.
Let's see. Alan, this one's for you from Ruth. Why are the Democrats so bad at messaging?
Well, it depends. You have a Democratic president of the United States, a Democratic House of Representatives, a Democratic Senate by one vote, albeit or even. So they're not doing so badly. But the Republicans are united by one thing, and that is, you know, holding on to power. And they know it, and their incomes are right up there to support that. So I don't know that the Democrats certainly are a circular firing squad. We know that.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, they're not doing so bad.
They're not doing so bad, but I would answer that question by just saying that the Democrats have a much bigger tent, you know, and it's not just you're not just appealing to Republicans can message on immigration. They can message on crime, you know, and that's all they have to do. Democrats have a much bigger tent, so many diverse interests. And so I think that's why sometimes it does feel like it's a circular firing squad.
Let's see. We go to a similar letter from Bob, who says a recent survey of people's knowledge of the child care credit found that 39% of those surveyed believe that the tax credits are a Trump-created benefit. Dems need to do a much better job messaging, or they'll be wasting a huge opportunity.
Well, that is hilarious. You're telling me the guy who had children separated from their parents is now sending checks to children? Come on.
It's important to remember that Mitt Romney floated the original idea for this, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
So, all right. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been to Kentucky or West Virginia, asks Jason. Not flying over it, but driving or better, riding a bike through them. I will defer to you in a moment, Aaron, because I know you recently were in West Virginia. The roads are a shambles, all of them except the ones the coal trucks use. Those are paid for by the taxpayers of those two states. They don't drive on them because they only go between the mines and the power plants or train yards, but they do pay for it in taxes, more pollution, and each year fewer jobs.
I have been to West Virginia. My step-cousin-in-laws live there and have spent some time there over the past 2 years, and you know, it definitely has.
You know, if you're going to have a step cousin in law, they should live in West Virginia. And just for central casting.
And there should be a banjo being played right now, too, as you're telling the story.
There was. There was.
I'm sorry.
Hey, watch that, David.
But, broadband access is spotty. Cell phone coverage is spotty. You can't blame it all on the mountains. And the other interesting thing. When you drive around West Virginia, Robert Byrd's name is on everything. If you want to talk about messaging and how you make it clear that, you know, the Democratic Party is working for the people of your state, yeah, it should be, you know, the Joe Manchin 77 bypass or whatever. Do what you have to do to get the message across, to get these things funded.
The author brings up a point here that I want to take a moment here and make sure that it's not lost on
us. Got about a minute. But okay.
You know, we talk about flyover states. I'm so happy that someone finally, you know, brought that to the attention of the American public, that we do fly over these states and we're not paying attention to them. Well, there are drive-through neighborhoods, too, like West Hill, like Arbor Hill, like South End, where there is a massive amount of poverty. But we just drive through the main thoroughfare and we pay no attention to what's happening there. And it's the same sense of abandonment that I think we speak of when we speak of flyover states.
Quick letter from Jess, who says to the previous letter writer, you clearly have no idea how much it costs to raise a child these days. Most families need to have two parents in the workforce and pay upwards of $12,000 to $15,000 per year for a child in daycare. Also, take into account that most young parents have large student loans and the price of everything is increasing. $100,000 certainly doesn't go very far. That from Jess. We will pause there. We will come back and go to other subjects. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soar is making up the program this morning. We'll have our last call when we come back, our last moments with our panel, and time for your letters. But first, news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. We have a wonderful panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares. We welcome your letters. Panel@wamc.org. Last call for our last 15 minutes together or so. Let's go to this story about Europe. We talk a lot about our climate issues, but Europe has unveiled a plan to shift from fossil fuel, setting up potential trade spats. So I like the story because I think I can get Aaron in on it, too. Maybe you two will join forces and write another editorial. Okay, the proposal would impose tariffs on some imports from countries with looser environmental rules. It would also mean the end of sales in the EU of new gas and diesel-powered cars in just 14 years. The most radical and possibly contentious proposal would impose tariffs on certain imports from countries with less stringent climate protection rules. The proposals also include eliminating the sales of new gas and diesel-powered cars in just 14 years and raising the price of using fossil fuels. Judith, we'll go to you first.
Well, this is a really interesting proposal, and emphasis on the word proposal. It's not in effect yet. And, you know, I think it goes entirely in the right direction. My heart always stops when I hear climate change plans that call for greenhouse gas reductions by 2050 or 2040. We are running out of time. And, you know, this European proposal was considered for quite a while, and it was unveiled in the week that Europe is just getting battered by devastating floods, really impacting Germany, other parts of Europe. Over 100 people dead, 1,300 people unaccounted for in one region in Germany. And of course, when you think of climate change, you think of really, you know, high temperatures, you think of devastating wildfires, but it's also extreme weather. The warmer atmosphere holds and releases more water. So you don't have to be a climate scientist to recognize in our own region, for instance, we have downpours. Lots more rain comes down in shorter periods of time, and our infrastructure is not equipped to handle it. Two nights ago in my neck of the woods in Rensselaer County, the flooding was devastating. Well, let me not say devastating. It was serious. Last week in New York City, you may have seen the late afternoon downpours causing major flooding in the subways and roadways. So climate change is here. I think this is a very reasonable proposal. Remember, 27 countries make up the EU, so this is significant. Of course, not England because of Brexit. And the idea of, I would call it a polluter import fee, this idea has now been embraced by congressional Democrats. This will all come to a head in November when world leaders meet in Glasgow for the COP26 international climate talks. And I will have my eye on China and how China reacts to this. And also, you know, Russia and Turkey, they produce a lot of iron and steel and aluminum. Keep in mind, the United States and China are the biggest emitters of greenhouse gases. And, you know, one of the criticisms of this proposal is how will countries that don't have a lot of money deal with these added costs? And the EU proposal includes something called a social climate fund, which is $83 billion to help transition countries that have economic problems to dealing with this polluter import fee. So I, you know, I'm getting quite desperate about the climate crisis. Business as usual is not working. You know, goals that get us reducing carbon in 2040, 2050 is, you know, is almost irrelevant at this point. So I think this is a really, really exciting and important proposal, and I hope it gets adopted.
What is it? Where do we fit in? Where does the United States fit in and our current policies? And if so, if we're going to keep up with this, what do we need to change, or where are we good? Doesn't seem like we're good.
No, we're not good, unfortunately. I mean, President Biden has supported a 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, but you know, he's having difficulty getting support for renewable energy. Chuck Schumer's talking a lot about electric vehicles and charging stations and building that infrastructure. Will that get congressional support? That is questionable. And we don't have anything like Europe is proposing in terms of moving away from fossil fuels. They would not allow for the sale of gas or diesel cars in Europe after 2035. We need that here. We're not even close to that. You know, we have some measly tax credits for electric vehicles and not enough charging stations in case you want to use it, your electric car, for beyond commuting, which is a good use for it. So we are way behind. We have so far to go, both at the state and the national level. In fact, the Biden emission reduction goals are more aggressive than New York's.
David?
Well, you know, it just seems like such an overwhelming challenge. But, you know, you see incrementally these proposals that give you some hope. And I don't want to catch you off guard here, Judith, but I do recall the fact that the United States government under then President Obama and Vice President Biden had bailed out the auto industry. And one of the conditions for those bailouts was that they were going to be reducing, you know, emissions significantly. And I think there were efforts by the Trump administration to destroy that compact. And despite the Trump administration's efforts, it seemed to me that the auto industry was pretty much moving in that direction, as evidenced by some of their trucks that they've put out. There's a lot more of the models that are coming out. And so that is still reason to be hopeful, right, Judith?
Yes. You know, the Obama administration and others had really good rules on fuel efficiency standards, which moved us toward hybrid cars, electric vehicles. And we also should remember investments in mass transit, bikeable communities, walkable communities are even more important. But this, David, I'm glad you're raising this. This is a clear example of the devastating impact of the Trump administration. Losing those 4 years, we're going to look back in history and see how significant that was. It is definitely in the right direction. It is incremental. And if I could paraphrase the noted climate writer activist Bill McKibben, who I have the highest respect for, he said, winning slowly on climate change is losing. So that's why this European proposal is so important. We have to get off fossil fuels. We have to stop building fossil fuel power plants and pipelines, because you build a fossil fuel power plant today, it's going to be around for 50 or 60 years. So we have a long, long way to go here. The science is clear. I mean, it's all around us. This weekend, we're expecting more record-breaking heat in the western United States. The wildfires are quite serious out west. The intense rainfall, the damage to infrastructure that we're seeing in our region. I mean, what more do you need? But, you know, ExxonMobil and Shell and plastic manufacturers have an iron grip on the Congress. Remember, Joe shared an article with us a few weeks ago that Joe Manchin made millions of dollars from his employment in the coal brokerage firm EnerSystems, and he continues, you know, this coal interest continues to pay him dividends. So because Joe Manchin is in the pocket of the coal industry, and because Kristen Sinema is who knows where, I think Congress, you know, is not going to endorse something like this really bold EU proposal.
We have a couple of moments on this. Part of this, talking about this, has to do with concerns over trade spats. Talk a little bit about that, Aaron.
Yeah, so the climate issue is clear, and to me, the economic issue is extremely clear, too. Reliance on fossil fuels is going to be a drag on growth for all countries going forward. So whichever country gets the head start in the manufacturing and the infrastructure needed for the foundation of an economy built on renewable energy is going to experience really large gains over the next couple decades, provided the world doesn't catch on fire by then. So there is, you know, people don't have
more than it already has.
People don't have a long-term horizon built into their brain. People don't save enough for retirement, let alone think about the implications of what the world looks like with sea levels and temperatures 100 years from now. So from an economic perspective, you have to incentivize businesses and consumers and politicians and show them the short-term gains, because that's what they recognize. That's why Joe Manchin's taking money from the coal industry. That's why the coal industry is donating funds to Joe Manchin. But you need to change the rules of the game and the flow of money so that it becomes extremely cost prohibitive to produce with fossil fuels and much lower cost with renewable energy.
And if I could, thank you. Excellent points, Aaron. If I could just add, the cost of solar and wind has come way down in many countries, cheaper than oil and gas and coal. But if you're an oil or a gas or a coal company, you don't care about that. You want to sell and burn those fossil fuels. So we are long past the time where, in addition to this bold proposal from the EU, it's the state governments and to some degree local governments who decide, does the pipeline get built?
Yeah.
Does the power plant get built? Does the coal mine expand? And I think we're to the point where we have to keep it in the ground. You have to keep fossil fuels in the ground. Do not extract them. Do not send them by pipeline to power plants and for oil and gas for transportation, because we are at the tipping point. The IPCC, the international body of scientists, about 3 years ago said we had about 13 years to avoid catastrophic climate change. I don't think we have that long.
There's also geopolitics involved here as well. I mean, you mentioned, you know, Russia, which seems to be their only expert. If you theoretically, if you wanted NATO to destroy, you know, the greatest enemy, it's you know, not embracing any more fossil fuel. But, you know, yes, you're going to impact the livelihood of your enemies, but you're also going to be impacting the livelihood of your allies, specifically in the Middle East. And so there's a lot more to this than just a simple environmental issue.
Alan?
And one part of all of this, of course, is the media's role in making this happen. We're very proud of Judith Henk, and I could listen to her all day long on all of this, except not always where gubernatorial politics are concerned. However, you know, when what WAMC does is extraordinary. And we got a letter here the other day saying, why don't you people talk about climate change more? Well, I defy anybody to find any station or any media group that has done more than we have. So there.
All right, we're out of time. My thanks to everybody this morning. Very nice to have you all here. Alan, thank you very much. Always good to talk. Judith, Aaron, David, thank you. We will we'll convene again next week. We'll be back after this short break.